Welcome to Spectrum from China America Radio, a weekly public service production featuring news, information, and stories of interest to our China America Radio listeners in the United States and around the world. Now, here's this week's host, Steve Warren.
Welcome back to part two of our conversation with Denny McMahon, the author of China's Great Wall of Debt. I'm Steve Warren on Spectrum, and Denny has been with us for last week and again this week talking about the ins and the outs of Chinese economy. So let's pick up where we left off last week. The topography of China is vast. I mean, it just goes forever and ever and ever, and each provincial region or ethnic region has its own background. And we said here during our own financial crisis in the United States about certain banks being too big to fail. I'm wondering if China is too big to succeed.
That's an incredibly good question, but I actually think it's the other way around. I think if you're talking about not just individual institutions that have taken up too much debt and have kind of become a little bit unwieldy, I think if you're taking the economy as a whole, I think China's great advantage is that it is so big. If you look back at the development of the United States, I mean, the great advantage the U.S. has always had is that it's a continental economy. And what that means is it has the population, it has the resources to sort of drive its own growth. And that's the advantage China has as well. It's almost a continental economy. Huge population, huge resources, and it can always sort of develop and support its own internal demand if it sort of restructures things in that direction.
One of the Chinese initiatives going on as we speak and into the future is the Belt and Road Project, which will hopefully enhance the capabilities to move goods and services throughout China, much the way as it did in the days of the Silk Road. Do you see the underpinnings in projects like that assisting the Chinese government, or is China taking on even more debt to create projects like that without any real sense of the true outcome?
I think it's still too early to pass judgment on the Belt and Road Project. I think on one level, what China is trying to achieve is fantastic for the broader region. I mean, there has been this fundamental dearth of quality infrastructure in so much of Asia, broadly defined, for such a long time. And finally, you have somebody who is willing to, a nation willing to step into the gap and provide the funding and the construction expertise to get a lot of this stuff done. But the devil is in the details. So the question is, will countries who borrow money from China, will they find themselves borrowing too much and unable to repay that debt? Or are you going to find even that Chinese financial institutions overextend themselves in countries that are then struggle to repay the debt? You're already seeing signs in a couple of countries that there is almost sort of a resentment building domestically against Chinese influence, because China in some way has sort of overextended itself or imposed in sort of certain local communities. So I think it's early days to say how successful this will be. And I think the Chinese government and Chinese firms will adapt to local conditions. They will learn their lessons. They'll change the way that they approach things in order to sort of try and make this more successful over time. But I think the questions about whether the money will always be there how willing they are to accept Chinese investment over the long term, I think these are still open questions, and only time will tell.
There's been suspicion on a variety of fronts. We go back to the powdered milk episodes from a few years ago, where some children got very sick and died because of some tainted powdered milk. And then over the years, many Chinese consumers have grown suspicious of Chinese goods themselves. Does that mean it's going to take some more time before China can start building the credibility of its own products, so its own consumers will prefer Chinese products over imports, which is now one of the reasons China has to import so much?
Absolutely. I think you listen to President Xi Jinping, though, and he kind of sees this as a priority to kind of raise the quality of domestically produced Chinese goods and raise the degree of faith that Chinese people actually have in those goods. I think we're a long way from Chinese people actually having a sort of restoring their faith in locally produced goods, particularly edibles and things that can really affect people's health. You have this phenomenon at the moment whereby there's almost like a hierarchy in China of trust, so that particularly when it comes to consumable goods, the goods kind of at the bottom of that hierarchy are locally produced Chinese goods, and then the next step up on the hierarchy is foreign produced goods, foreign brands that are then produced domestically in China, and then foreign brands that are produced overseas and then imported to China. And then you have this phenomenon of a lot of Chinese people who have the financial resources, and particularly those with young children and those living in major cities, what they only really trust is if they're sure that what they are buying is exactly the same products that foreigners in foreign supermarkets in Australia and the US are buying themselves. And so in my own native Australia, you have a phenomenon of Daigo. Something like 40,000 people in China are effectively operating as personal shoppers back in China. Whereby they go to supermarkets and they go to, you know, pharmacies, and they buy directly off the supermarket shelves, you know, products that people back in China actually want. And this is a way for Chinese people who are genuinely suspicious and worried about the quality of the goods that they can actually buy in China to be able to do an end run around those sort of concerns and buy directly from overseas. I think certainly this is something that China wants to fix in the long term, but in the short term, it's for many people, it's the only possible workaround to actually be able to deal with their fundamental concerns about the tampering of food and the quality of what's produced domestically.
Our guest is Denny McMahon. He's written the China's Great Wall of Debt book, and it's full of examples, full of stories, full of case studies about things going on in the Chinese economy. And there's a couple of anecdotal stories that I found to be interesting. One about the fact that China manufactures 80% of the world's ballpoint pens. And I thought I would lighten things up a little bit and let you walk us through the world of ballpoint pens and how it works and how seeing made in China maybe is not all that true.
Yeah, the ballpoint pen story is quite fascinating because a few years ago, China's Premier Li Keqiang was at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And when he came back from Switzerland, he complained to the Chinese press about the quality of Chinese-produced ballpoint pens. So I think China produces something like 3.8 billion ballpoints per year, which is most of the world's supply. And yet he'd had such a good experience using Swiss ballpoint pens that he came home and was like, why can't we produce what they produce? And so there was a huge amount of soul searching going on in China's domestic ballpoint pen production industry. And it sort of came out that what really happens in China is, although it produces so many pens, it doesn't so much make pens as assemble them. So for example, most of the ink that goes into ballpoint pens is still sort of imported from overseas. The big issue is the production of the actual ballpoint, the actual ball bearing, and actually also the nib that goes into the pens as well, because although China produces an incredible amount of steel, it produces far more steel than it could conceivably actually use. It isn't capable of, up until recently at least, it hasn't been able to produce the quality of the steel and that is necessary to go into making the balls that go into ballpoint pens. The other issue as well is that sort of ball and nib combination at the top of a ballpoint pen is also highly technical. You kind of need the ball bearings to be able to be made to a precise measurement, because if they're off a little bit, then they get stuck in the nib, or if they're too small, then they leak too much ink. And so there's a whole lot of extremely technical aspects to making a ballpoint pen that up until recently the Chinese haven't been able to do. When I wrote the book, China hadn't been able to do that, but very recently, a Chinese steel manufacturer has announced that it is now capable of producing the ball bearings in a ballpoint pen. And so the reason China had traditionally made ballpoint pens is that it would assemble all these various components, everything from the nib and the ball and the ink cartridges and the springs. They'd be assembled in factories throughout China by hand. But China is no longer a cheap place to manufacture as it used to be. And so China still produces a whole lot of ballpoint pens, but it uses machines to do it. But those machines are invariably made in Switzerland. So you have this ridiculous situation whereby China is the epicenter of ballpoint pen manufacturing in the world, but all the really valuable components, the ball bearings, the ink, the actual machines that make them, are imported from overseas. And this kind of speaks volumes about sort of the industrial transformation that China is trying to undergo at the moment. Is this recognition that it can't be the low-end manufacturing hub that it has been for such a long time. It needs to move up the industrial value-added chain. It needs to be able to produce the ball bearings itself, the ink itself, the machines that make it itself. And that sort of mentality is being applied not just to pens, but a whole raft of industries. Things like I was talking about before, like semiconductors and robotics, because China has the same issue when it comes to making iPhones. Almost all of the iPhones in the world are produced in China. And yet, when we say produced in China, only about 8 to 10% of the value of an iPhone is actually added in China. The guts of these phones are invariably imported from Germany and Japan and South Korea and Taiwan. And so China is now saying we need to be able to produce the semiconductors and the other components for things like iPhones ourselves.
We've mentioned how vast the nation of China is. However, that said, that does bring into question the fact that the energy costs are extremely high in China. And with all of those resources, but the distance between where the resources need to go and where they originate can double, treble the cost at getting it there. Getting back to what we said about being too big to succeed because of what you need one place is manufactured or mined or brought somewhere else. Same with agriculture. You know, by the time you grow something on the west side of China and it gets to the east side of China, it's rotten because it's had to travel for like 5 days on a train. Address that. Address the fact that there are so many resources, but they don't seem to be in the right place at the right time.
All right. Well, perhaps the best way to approach that is there's another story that I write about in the book about a Chinese entrepreneur that takes a textile entrepreneur. So this guy, he started off his career working for a state-owned enterprise, and then when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, he went out on his own and bought a whole lot of machines that spin cotton into yarn and was extremely successful at that for years. And then I met him in 2013, I think it was, because he was planning a massive expansion of his production facilities, except he wasn't doing it in China. He was packing up his machines, boxing them up, and sending them to South Carolina. And the reason was the cost of producing yarn in South Carolina was cheaper than what it would cost him to expand his factories in Hangzhou, which is where he was based. And the reasons were, there were a number of reasons. One was the cost of land. So if he wanted to expand a factory in Hangzhou, the cost of land in so many of these eastern provinces, particularly in reasonably large cities, have just gone through the roof in recent years. Now, of course, if he wanted to, he could move west. But the downside of moving west is then he was a lot further away from ports and a lot further from the other factories that would need his yarn to spin into fabric. So on the other hand, land in South Carolina was dirt cheap compared to anything he'd be paying in China. On eastern China. The second issue was electricity. So the problem with electricity in China is that China produces a lot of its has a lot of coal-fired power plants, but the cost of coal produced in China, although it's often cheap to produce, it's of a much, much lower quality than coal imported, for example, from Australia, and is also far more polluting. And so China imports higher quality coal from overseas. It imports almost all of its oil from overseas. Meanwhile, in the United States, you kind of have this frail revolution and natural gas revolution. And so the cost of energy was so much cheaper for him in South Carolina than it could ever be where he was operating in China. And then the other big issue, there were a couple of big issues. One was wages, but the other one was the cost of cotton. And the cost of buying cotton in the United States was also inordinately cheaper than what it would be in China. And the reason wasn't so much that he was a long way from where the cotton producers were in China. It wasn't the transportation costs. What it was is China's land rules, land ownership rules, are such that farmers in China don't have rights really over their land. They have long-term leases, but they can't, up until recently, and only in, for the most part, any changes have only been on a trial basis in certain areas. But most farmers in China, they can't sell their land, they can't lease their land to other people. They can't, if they move to the city, they can't sell their land and let somebody else amalgamate it. And so, whereas in the United States, cotton is farmed on vast, sprawling plots of land. In China, it's farmed on very small plots of land. And so you don't have the economies of scale. Individuals can't afford the machines that farmers in the United States can afford. And so the cost of producing cotton in China is so much more expensive. But because of a quota system in China, Chinese farmers have to, Chinese textile manufacturers like this entrepreneur have to buy Chinese cotton first before they can buy American cotton. So at the end of the day, it was just a lot cheaper for his production facilities to actually just move to the United States and buy American cotton without having to put up with a quota system.
Very, very interesting. The name of the book is China's Great Wall of Debt. It's from Denny McMahon, who's with us on China America Radio on our Spectrum program. In wrapping up our extensive discussion here, and we've only just scratched the surface of what the probabilities and possibilities are, what is your prognosis for the Chinese economy, let's say, in the next 5 years and then again in the next 20?
You know, Steve, I mean, people have been predicting the imminent collapse or decline of the Chinese economy for as long as I've been learning Chinese. And so I'm certainly wary of saying with any great confidence exactly what we can expect to happen next. Certainly a financial crisis isn't out of the question. And that's not me saying it. I mean, the Chinese senior Chinese officials have been saying that for the last couple of years. And that's why over the last 12 months, we've seen some real moves to try and rein in some of the excesses of the financial system. So a crisis isn't out of the question. Certainly some economists suggest that maybe China could experience something like a lost decade. Certainly one economist I quite respect says that the next global recession could actually start in China. But all those sort of possibilities aside, we could just see the pace of growth in China slow significantly. But you've got to remember that if growth in China slows from 6.9%, which it was last year, to something like 2 or 3%, then all of our expectations about the role that China is going to play in the world in the near future change radically. So at 2% growth, whereas that seems fairly robust by the experience of anyone in a developed economy, if China were to grow at 2% a year, that would mean that it is no longer catching up with the United States. At 3% a year, it would take decades to catch up with the United States. And so the only thing I really feel I can say with any great certainty is that at this point, China is very much shrouded in an aura of inevitability. There is a sense globally that China will inevitably become the world's biggest economy, that it will become inevitably be the dominant force in Asia and even inevitably challenge the United States for the role of global power. But I think given the economic challenges that China is facing at this moment, this is everything that goes from having too much debt, the need to change the way that it grows, the fact that it has a rapidly aging population, and the fact that it's no longer a cheap place to manufacture anymore. You put all of those forces together and China is facing some amazing economic challenges all at once. For me, I think the vision of China's ascent being inevitable is completely misplaced. It's certainly conceivable. It might well happen, but it shouldn't be our default expectation.
It appears that President Xi is going to be around for a while. Do you think he's up to the task?
I think in some ways he clearly is. We've seen President Xi over the last couple of years in particular take a harder line dealing with some of China's underlying economic problems, more so than any leader in the last 10 years. We've seen him try and deal with China's environmental problems by closing down polluting factories, dealing with its industrial overcapacity problems by doing the same thing, putting in some very aggressive economic reformers to deal with risks in the financial system. And so I think to the extent that China, that the excesses and the waste and the risk-taking that's really accumulated in China's financial system over the last decade, the extent to which that needs to be cleaned up, I think Xi Jinping has shown that he is willing to do something about it. I think the big unanswered questions at this point is what happens when the economy starts slowing below current levels. Well, certainly the government has been willing to accept significantly slower growth than what has been the norm for the last three decades. China's no longer growing at 10% a year. 6.9% last year is significantly slower. But the question is, at what point does it become too slow? And certainly Xi's vision for China's future isn't one of slow growth. It is one in which China assumes a role in the global order, which Xi kind of presents as being a restitution of China's proper place in the global order. As with all things in China, there's always many moving parts to how the economy works, and a lot has been going on over the last 18 months or so to address the excesses and the risks in China's financial system. I'm trying to delve into that, trying to work out exactly what's going on, and trying to assess the degree to which they'll be successful.
Denny, it's great for you to stop by and visit us here and spend so much time on Spectrum. Happy and safe travels. And we look forward to catching up again sometime soon.
Thanks very much, Steve. It's been great talking to you.
Join us every weekend for Spectrum on China America Radio, a weekly public service program featuring news, information, lifestyle experiences, and stories of interest to our listeners in the United States and around the world. If you have suggestions for future topics or guests to be featured on an upcoming Spectrum program, send them to us at programming@chinaamericaradio.com.